Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, best-selling author R.O. Kwan discusses her new novel, Exhibit. The following conversation originally took place May 5th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome. My name is Carrie Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. Thank you all for being here and valuing the past, present, and future of writing. We're thrilled to welcome R.O. Kwan in person to the American Writers Museum for the first time after a storm kept her from Chicago during her last book tour. Her new novel, Exhibit, has been called the sexiest novel of the year, a highly sensory experience, and a hypnotic romance. She is the best-selling author of The Incendiaries, which was named a best book of the year by more than 40 publications and was a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle John Leonard Award. With Gareth Cannell, Kwan co-edited the best-selling Kink, a New York Times notable book. Her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and elsewhere. She's joined in conversation tonight about Exhibit by Nami Moon, whose novel Miles from Nowhere was a national bestseller and winner of numerous awards. She was also an advisor to this museum in its very early stages. So please join me in welcoming them both, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out, and thank you, Reese, for visiting the city of the big shoulders. We are also the city of the big bookshelves, so we're glad you're here. I thought maybe to start us off, if you wanted to, you could give us a little reading, however long you want to, and then we'll throw some questions at you afterwards. Does that sound all right?
That sounds okay. Great. And thank you so much to the American Writers Museum, and thank you to the Seminary Co-op for having me. And thank you all for being here. And thank you to Nami, who's writing Miles from Nowhere. When I first read it, it like rearranged my brain. If you somehow haven't read it, I recommend that you run out and get that as well. I love being in the city so much. It's such a beautiful city, and the fucking cheese and the pizza, man. The pizza is so good. I'm allergic to cheese, but it's my favorite food. It's one of the minor tragedies of my life. It's all right. But I can have it if I take Benadryl, Lactaid, and Advil. And so sometimes I will do that. And put up with the sort of like rashes I get otherwise. And y'all's pizza, it's out of control. I don't know how you stay away from it. I would eat it every single day. I would just walk around doped up on Benadryl and put up with it. But yeah, thanks for being here. So, it's so good to be here. Exhibit just published a couple of weeks ago, so it feels really fresh to me still. When my publisher sent me this book, they send you, like a couple of boxes worth of books. They're your author copies. And I screamed, not necessarily from joy, I threw a blanket over it so that I wouldn't have to see it. That was still overwhelming. So then I chucked it into a closet. And then at some point I was supposed to make an unboxing video. I don't know if you've ever seen these. So they like you to make unboxing videos, which are just, you open the box, look at your book for the first time, and people get emotional. So I did that, and they want you to tape yourself and put it on social media because people like to see you get emotional on social media. So I did that, and then I cried, and my publisher was like, great, this is great. And we put that up on socials. But after that, I actually sealed the box back up and I chucked it back into the closet because it was just too much to me. I worked on this book for 9 years. We'll probably talk about it, but there was a lot of sort of terror and anxiety that went into writing this book. And the fact that I'm only holding it for maybe like the ninth time at this point. And it still feels like a live coal. When I first told years ago, when I told my editor about the novel that would become Exhibit, I said I couldn't say much about it yet, but that it was full of sex. And she said, perfect. Great. That's all you need to tell people. That's all I need to know. And we laughed, but in a larger sense, Exhibit is an exploration of desire and the ferocious pursuit thereof, including desires having to do with bodies, art, ambition, queer exuberance, religion, and sex. With Exhibit, I was hell-bent on exploring a question I have found fascinating. Why is it that I feel so strongly pushed by the world and by people I know to want certain things? And just as strongly pushed to not want other things. So every day of my life, I feel a great deal of pressure to want to be an exemplary daughter of, sister of, mother of, friend of, community member of. It's all mediated through that of, that preposition. And the things I feel pushed not to want, to hide, suppress, kill my appetite for, include things like anything for my body, for sure. Food, sex, absolutely. Ambition, artistic ambition. Even a day to myself feels like something that has to be defended. And, you know, it's so important to me to be involved in my communities. I love my friends. You know, I want to be a good daughter. Like, all of this matters to me. But what is so dangerous? What is so wayward about me wanting for myself? So that was one of the first questions that led me to this book. And in a more general sense, I've been fascinated, and the book is fascinated, by the strength of desire and how difficult it is for me, and I think a lot of people, to ever reason or persuade myself out of my strongest longings. And so in exhibit, I ended up following a few people, Korean women, who want a great deal, and to see what happens if they're given the space to run at full tilt after what they want. So very quick content warning. In the first half minute of what I'll read, there's a double suicide that takes place 100 plus years ago. It's loosely based on a family story. Please take care of yourself and feel free to skip out for that part. I'll now read from the start of exhibit. Last time I was in Chicago for an event, I had family in the room. And I think this time I don't. And particularly with this book, I've been begging everyone related to me by law or blood to please stay away. That we'll all be better off this time around. But for the rest of y'all, here's the first chapter. One, she'd go up the tall pine first. He flung his leg on a bough close behind. She didn't slip, her leaps agile. Hanbok silk, bright, swift, flared with each jump. If cloth tangled with the sprig, he lunged to help. In the fresh light, they kept going as high as possible. His parents, upset, hadn't slept. He'd spoken the past night of his plan to wed a Kisaeng. Startled, his parents said he must be joking. No Kisaeng paid to sing, jig, and flirt in public had the right to wed a Han. Not just a Han, the prized first son obliged to pass along his line. He'd beg pardon, then forget this whore of a girl. Instead, as I told Lydia, he replied that he loved this Kisaeng. She'd be his wife. If you don't stop talking, his father said, I'll kill you. Lips tight, the sun left. Night lifted. Oil-polished hanji doors slid open. A maid wailed. Paired bodies hung from the pine, hanboks rippling. Necks breaking, they died. In my omma's telling, this old tale proved lasting, trailing bodies, spoiled lives, and evil I'd also perhaps inherit. People said the Kisaeng spirit, abiding, hostile to all Hans, kept us cursed. It might be nothing, but spite held a ghost close to the living. It was best, though, not to talk of this spirit. I ought to tell future offspring, a husband. No one else, darling, Oma said. Just by talking, I'd rustle up the Kisaeng's ghost. Still, it might find me, this birthright evil. I'd flag it through a wild urge to risk for a futile single love all the ties I rated high. I had to kill this longing. If I didn't, I'd light my life on fire. I said I'd listen. For a while, I did. But that June night in Marin with Lydia, I felt this pledge's hold like a hexed rope, shred, rip, then fall. Philip, you'll ask how I told this person I had just met what I kept from you. I've tried figuring it out, sifting the burnt pile of all that I ignited. It's true that with Lydia, I let go of rules by which I'd lived. Not long after the night in Marin, she fixed a gag to my face. It was big, spit wet, the globe fell out. Lydia, impatient, applied foil tape. It stayed on but left the skin sheet tape shining red. I had a rash, allergic. I told Philip I had reacted to a lip balm. But if not for the lying, I'd have loved this rash. I forgot to be vain. It was put up like a sign, as though I might be hers. I'll stop there.
Thank you. You know how sometimes when you read it and you have a voice in your mind, and then usually when an author reads it, they kind of ruin it for you because your voice was better somehow. But it's exactly the way I heard it. It's amazing. Thank you so much. I'll start off with this sort of a question because I just noticed that, first of all, I read this book in two sittings. I want to, you know, and you have to know that I'm a very, very slow and meticulous reader. So the fact that I read it in two sittings is, I think it is propulsive. There's what's being done linguistically is really intriguing to me. There's like a staccato and there's sort of a lot of monosyllabic pacing to it. The sentences, I'm going to make up this word. The sentences, I kept on thinking they were very scapular. I think that's your bones in the back of your shoulder, like that scapula. It feels very sort of finely carved out. There's barely any fat in the sentences. It's just all protein. Lots of, I don't know, I'm hungry, so I'm thinking. And so I think all of these things and the subject matter and this character, Jin, and her relationship with Lydia, really makes it a propulsive read. But as you're reading it, I was thinking about this. By the way, I have like 6 pages of questions, but I'm just going to wing it now. I was thinking about this, the Gisaeng thinking, like, we can't really talk about the Gisaeng, right? Don't utter this, right? Don't say anything about my desires. Don't say, keep these sort of, you know, what Wittgenstein would say, whatever you can't speak clearly about, that should remain in silence, right? But here we are, as writers, isn't it our job to essentially to try and articulate the indecipherable or the unutterable? I don't know. What do you think? Do you feel like is this what you were trying to do, to articulate this thing that you couldn't quite articulate it to yourself even? You had to write it to figure it out, maybe.
Oh, that's such a beautiful question. And thank you for those words about the writing itself. That means so much to me coming from you.
She knows I hate everything.
You know, part of the reason that writing this book came with so much terror is that Korean women, we're both Korean, Korean women aren't supposed to, we're not really supposed to say anything about sex. We're not really supposed to talk about our desires. We're kind of supposed to put ourselves last in every single possible moment. Everyone else goes first. It wasn't that long ago that a Korean woman could be divorced for talking too much. And, you know, her family, her husband could just decide that you talk too much, we're getting divorced. And that was what the law said anyway. And divorce was really dangerous for a Korean woman because a lot of Korean women were not educated. So that meant that they were not going to be able to support themselves. And I'm definitely not supposed to give any indication in sex that in public that I've ever had sex, let alone thought about sex, let alone wanted sex. All Korean children have been immaculately conceived. And so with all of that, writing a book that centers desire, it came with so many what were often daily panic attacks and anxiety attacks. And the message that kept coming from my body, and it was a message that I couldn't argue with, as hard as I tried, the message kept saying, run, you're going to die, they're going to kill you, the killers are at the door. Mm-hmm. And I would just be like, body, it's a novel. Other people have written about sex. They have not, at least in the US, I'm knocking on wood, I'm very superstitious, they have not been killed. And then my body would still just be like, run. I had these hours long panic attacks, which Dr. Google said should not be possible. Panic attacks are only supposed to last about 20 minutes because they're hard enough on your body that your body's supposed to quit after that length of time. Finally talked to a real doctor. The doctor said I had rolling panic attacks. And rolling panic attacks are one panic attack leads to the next. And so they can go on for hours the way they do for me. And admittedly, my first reaction was weird pride. I was like, wow, I'm so tough. I have outlier panic attacks. but it wasn't a skill I wanted to have developed. So yeah, I think I really was in a lot of ways. I wanted to write into these silences, write into these spaces where my body keeps saying, you're not supposed to say a damn word about any of this. And I wanted to do that in part because, you know, part of what I value so much about literature and art is in times when I have felt desperately lonely, when I have felt marked as being apart from the world because of what I thought, wanted, felt, books, literature, art have met me and said over and over and said, you are not alone, and said, you are not, like, this solitude is not real, it's imagined. And so if that's what books and art have given me, then what am I even doing as a writer if I'm not trying to offer that back?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I mean, I know there are writers out here. This is, you sometimes, I think for me, I have to write it, or at least try to write it, to figure out what it is that I feel about X. And in this sense, I could see this character, you know, this attempt to participate in certain acts and certain lies and certain, to try and figure out what it is that she actually feels about desire, and really what she feels about her own artwork, right? Like, I think she's suffering from photographer's block a little bit, right? And this experience with Lydia helps open up certain things, and other experiences help open up. So now I'm thinking of Teresa Hakyung Cha. I don't know if anyone. No, she's a Korean American French. I mean, she writes in many different languages. But before she wrote Dictée, which y'all should read it if you want to be challenged a little bit, she did these performance pieces where it's a close up of her mouth, and the video is black and white, very grainy, and it's her just trying to utter a sound, but it's the beginning of an utter. So it's just like minutes of her going like that. And I can see in some ways this desire to speak out and express herself, right? She's kind of, she gets into bondage a little bit. And can you talk a little bit about how in this book it seems to be like she's actually participating in S&M and bondage, but through, ironically, it is the thing that helps her be liberated. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of the irony of things, right? Where you're supposed to be married and you're supposed to love and you're supposed to grow, but that actually is the thing that makes her feel trapped. Whereas bodily she is trapped, right, in bondage, but it actually makes her feel liberated.
Yeah, that
like little chiasmic structure. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So I will second the recommendation of Dictée if you haven't read it. That's been a formative text for me. I had it was a pretty ecstatic experience. The New Yorker asked me to review or write about a reissue of it, and so I spent a lot of time with it. And it was just it's really kind of just like it's a mind bending work that. One of the most powerful things about it, there's so much that's powerful, is it doesn't bend to the pressure to make historical and collective and personal traumas legible to the outside. And so, it was written in, it published in 1982. And what a feat. What kind of pressures must she have been under? And
yeah. I don't even call it it's an artist book, if anything. It's just, she just did what she wanted to do.
I mean, it's incredibly inspiring, freeing book, liberating book. And with exhibits. So, I co-edited this anthology, Kink, with my friend Garth Greenwell. And, it's a collection of stories that have to do with kink. And I think because I co-edited that book, and now with what's in this book, I think people imagine that I must be like incredibly liberated, and I must be like just like super open with the world. And I am so far from liberated. I'm ex-Catholic. I'm ex-Protestant. I'm ex-evangelical. My life goal, until I lost the faith, was to be, I say pastor, but honestly, I wanted to be a saint. Like, I wanted to commune with the divine. I wanted to be an isolated mystic, like maybe living on a pillar or in a cave. I was open to the possibilities, but I wanted ecstatic visions. I wanted to talk with I'm not a chill person. And that didn't happen. But it has proven impossible for me to shake off the shame and guilt that have come from all these traditions, from being Korean, from being a woman, from being ex-Catholic, from being ex-evangelical. And what I've realized instead is that maybe it's possible to write from inside that lack of freedom, that you don't have to be liberated to do liberated and liberating things. You don't have to feel free to do freeing things. Mm-hmm. And so for Jin, so all of that is an intro to say it wasn't until like 17 days ago that that I finally started saying in public. So yeah, incidentally, like I'm personally interested in kink. That had in all my talking about that anthology, including writing essays, arguing against really harmful ideas about kink being inherently abusive, misogynistic, etc. And for anyone who doesn't know, one way to define kink is that it can define any sexual practice that falls outside the lines and very narrow lines of what is considered acceptable sex. And so, and I'll also throw out that in a compendium study of 60 studies of medical studies into BDSM and kink, most of the studies were looking into questions like, are these people extremely fucked up? Like, is there something just really wrong with them? Like what is going on? And all the studies were like, they seem to be just like everybody else. Super weird. Anyway, and then this compendium study pulled together all this data, and they estimated that maybe 40 to 70% of people are kinky. And that could well be an underestimation because of the stigmas attached around it. But it's only
that means seven of you at least. In this room are into
kink. Yeah, and I know I have friends watching from online, so there's a yeah. good number of you. That's like an eighth grade bio when my bio teacher was like, at least 10% of you are queer, and my extremely Korean extremely Asian classmates like who had never met a queer person that we knew of, we were all like, who? Turned out it was me. Yeah. Jin is for me, as well as for a lot of kinky people, as well as for Jin, there is so much pain that can come with being at war with our desires, with having a world tell you your body is wrong, what you want is wrong. And for Jin to finally, with Lydia, this ballerina that she gets completely obsessed with, to finally start exploring what she herself wants, what she's known that her body wants, but has been completely just like trying to press down for all of her life. That comes with so much freedom. That comes with so much joy. And some of those pages felt so much joy when I was writing them for Jin and for the and yeah.
Yeah.
And she's not able to find that in her marriage.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, this is going to sound really ridiculous, but I'll try it out. So there are a lot of recurring motifs in this book about cages. Or themes about entrapment, imprisonment, right? Lydia is described, or I'm sorry, Kisaing is, you know, described as a captive bird. Lydia, I think, is this, she goes into a lion's cage or something. There are a lot of cages, right? But then I was thinking, well, we think cage and we think imprisonment. We're trapped, right? But then I was thinking, well, maybe for the bird, the bird is actually thinking protection, right? And I also think that sometimes when we do have boundaries, we do find more freedom in it, versus if you're given an endless amount of options, then you sort of feel stuck and you can't make these decisions for yourself. And so I'm thinking that Jin, this character who has been raised in a very conventional sort of religious bound, because she has been, at some point, the perspective switched from, oh, this is protection, and this is love, or whatever, and her perspective switched, right? And then, oh, this is actually, I feel trapped in there. This is actually liberating. So my question to you is, it seems like Philip, her husband, wanting to have a baby, that's the thing that triggers, is that? Does that feel like having a baby? Is Jin reacting to that question? And is that sort of the inciting incident for the whole journey for her? What do you think?
That's a great question. God, Nami, I love your brain so much.
These are probably boring for you because you haven't read the book. But, stay with me. I have some really funny questions. Stay with me.
So again, this is giving nothing away. This happens very early in the book. We learned that right before the book started, Jin and her husband Philip. So they've been together a long time. They started dating in college, and Jin's now 29. They'd agreed from the start that both were sure they didn't want kids. And then not long before the book starts, her husband, Philip, just wakes up and is like, oh my God, I do want a kid. And it starts for him with, he's holding a friend's baby and he realized that the baby's head, the scent, he's just like, I need more of this in my life. And you know, this can happen. Some people think that they don't want kids and they wake up not wanting kids. Jin is sure, she's adamant that she doesn't want kids. And that comes in part from one of my own great fears. I feel so I'm often writing out of my great fears, which is that I don't have kids, and I've known as long as I can remember wanting that I don't want kids. And of course, as happens with people who don't want kids, I've been told my whole life that I'll change my mind, and that I don't, often by total strangers, like it'll be just someone I just met, and I'm like, Matt, really, I'm going to change my mind. You know my heart and my body better than I do. All right, great, dude. But you know, I've been told, and I grew up in a very Korean community, one of those Korean enclaves in LA, where my high school was so Korean that non-Koreans took Korean classes at my public school so that they could know what the Koreans were saying when we talked shit in Korean, which we did readily. And so that's how Korean it was. And in Korean communities, being a parent is so baked into the language that I didn't know a single adult's except as their names were always the mother of X, the father of X. That's still how I know them. I don't know anything else about their names. It would actually be rude to call them anything else. And so I was told that I was impossible, that it wasn't possible for me not to want a child, that this could not exist. And so I think in multiple ways, I've been told for much of my life, it's also true that Korean people, there are still a lot of Korean people who believe that queerness is a bizarre, exotic illness that affects other people, and definitely not us. And so that's another dimension in which I have these multiple dimensions in which I've been told my whole life that I can't, that I don't exist. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, I'm right here. I seem to be existing as far as I can tell. So Jin is heartbroken because, this is one of those things, right, that you can't really compromise on. King Solomon knew there's no such thing as half a child and half not a child. One child is not a compromise. Jin and Philip love each other very much. They're not sure how to move forward. And Jin feels, even though she knows it's not fair, even though she knows Philip also has this powerful desire that he can't wish away, Jin feels betrayed. And Jin feels that he is picking an imaginary hypothetical being over her. And so it's at this juncture that this fascinating ballerina comes into Jin's and Philip's life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I did not grow up, we had very different childhoods. I think because, I ran away from home when I was 13. I never went back. So my childhood is completely filled with unconventional aspects. Whereas I think you were really like mired in that, all that Koreanness. I'm so sorry. Are you okay? It'll be okay.
I also love us.
But it came with
a million rules. Let's say that.
No, but it sounds so frightening. Like all that Koreanness, I would feel a little bit overwhelmed probably by that. But this pressure to have kids or to procreate seems to be, in this book, it goes directly against her desire to create art, right? It's almost as like the epigraph in the book is, you know, am I a monster or is this what it means to be human, right? As this sort of dichotomy, like, am I this or am I this, right? And it's almost as if, you know, saying, well, if I do this, if I go down this path, then this other path will start to fade, right? I can't be a photographer the way I want, the kind of photographer I want to be. Do you feel this in real life where you feel if I choose child comes with whatever that is, and then that makes you do X, and then you can't do these other things? I mean, forget not being able to, you know, have BDSM parties or whatnot, but you can't even like take a photo for a few years, right? Do you feel any kind of...
You know, it felt very important to me in the book to have Jin feel, as I feel, that Jin's desire to not have a kid is like mine. It's just elemental. It's just a part of who I am. Mm-hmm. I've never located the desire in my body. It feels as foreign to me as I've compared it before. I wrote an essay in The Guardian about it, where I said it feels like being told that I'm supposed to birth an ostrich. Like why? What does this have to do with me? And then one day I learned I don't have to, and I was like, oh my God, thank God, I actually have no interest in ostriches. That was the point at which my parents finally stopped pressuring me to have kids. I had to communicate through a newspaper. And then they were like, all right, she seemed to really mean it. She's comparing it to birds. And then, But it was also important to me to show, because obviously I have friends who have kids and are mothers and are parents, you know, like, and are amazing artists and have mothers. And so there's a character in there who's Jin's closest friend. And she's Elise is an incredible artist. And she has a rough period, but she doesn't lose her art. And that felt, and I've had a lot of parent friends, especially parent friends with small children who are sort of in that like really difficult time of almost no time to yourself. They've like, when they read it, they've said, thank God she gets back to her art.
Right. Actually, I'm really glad you brought up Elise. There's a line in the book where, you know, Elise has just delivered the baby, I think maybe a month or so. And the Jin character and Philip are visiting Elise. And supposedly they're there to help mop and clean and wash and whatever it is that friends are supposed to do. My friends did none of that. That's why. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Boo. That's right. Yeah. But so Jin and Philip go to the house and they're supposed to do these things, but then they realize that Elise had already tidied, that the place was actually quite good. And there's a line right in there where there's this the sense that this is Elise still performing, this is still the public Elise, that there, she didn't want to show the cracks of motherhood and parenting, which, you know, if you come to my house, you will see a lot of cracks. And so it made me think about this book, and I started seeing a lot of motifs on just performance, everyday performance, that we all just, even though I'm not wearing a tulle skirt and I'm not a ballet, but I am performing. I'm performing for my students, I'm performing for here, I'm performing for you now. Do you think writing is an act of performance as well? And are you performing sort of, I don't know, what do you think about performance? How about I just leave it at that? What do you think about this everyday performance that we all, you perform as a good daughter, good wife, good Korean, right? What happens to that?
You know, I think, that was another behind some of the terrible anxiety I had around this book was, some of the things Jin wants sexually, can be misinterpreted as dovetailing exactly with the worst stereotypes about people who look like you and me, that we're docile, that we're pliant, that we like to be mistreated, that we exist to serve. You know, it's not just that this stereotype is absurd and ludicrous. It's also incredibly harmful. It helps get us hurt and killed. And you know, for a while I tend to write nonfiction that often has to do with varieties of marginalization and oppression, and including gender and race, including right after the Atlanta spa shootings. It's always, I still can't talk about this without getting very emotional, but that's okay. Some things bring a lot of emotion. And I wrote a piece a few days after the shootings that resonated with a lot of people, and I ended up going on the radio and talking on podcasts about it. And then so I ended up hearing from thousands of people about their experiences of gendered racism. And you might not remember, but the shooter, he said that he killed the people he killed, most of whom were Asian women who worked at spas. He said that he killed them because they were temptations, because he had a sex addiction. Sex addiction is not something that is recognized as a real thing. And the media ran with this story. The media easily believed this story that women who look like me and you are such sexual temptations that it was a medical condition. It's rooted in our histories in this country. The first anti-immigration law came in 1875 with the Page Act, which said that which forbade Chinese women from entering the country because we were immoral. And so I was terrified all along. And after the shootings, I became much more terrified because of adding to the stereotype with this book that I would personally add to and hurt this horrible lie that gets so many of us hurt. And I'm still afraid. But it's also true that it felt as though, again, this loneliness thing, like I so strongly believe, I think that if I believe in walking toward fear with my work, I believe that I'm afraid of putting something down. If I'm writing something that I can barely stand to put on a page, that there's probably something there, mm-hmm. that there's probably truth there that I would want to meet as a reader. And so that was part of what went into it.
Performance.
And so I wanted to write the secret things, you know, and I think that's part of what I go to books for, is I don't go to books for the things people say at parties. I don't go to books for the things that are acceptable to say at a dinner table. Mm-hmm. I go to books for the things that people say to themselves, can barely say to themselves. I want the secrets. You know, Maggie Nelson has talked about how when she, the things that she's written in her books that she felt desperately ashamed of having put down, that those are the things readers write back to her. Those passages are the things people pick out and write back to her and say, thank you for saying that. I feel seen. Like, I feel understood for the first time. And so, yeah.
It's so scary to write sometimes, even if it's fiction, under the veil of fiction, you know that you're going to be judged as like, oh, this is partly true, isn't it? You know, and so it's frightening sometimes to put yourself on the page. I started dabbling in nonfiction right now. I'm terrified the whole time. And even with my novel, the first one, I got emails. Yeah. You know, I got emails. How dare you portray Asians in this way? You know, don't we already have enough of, you know? That said, can we talk a little bit about, now that we're sort of going into this sort of dangers of writing territory, you know, are there any writers here in the audience? Raise your hand. There you go. The first step is to admit that you are a writer. Congratulations. What advice would you give to a writer, aspiring writer, in grappling with putting your taboos on the page and talking about those taboos in public? Any advice for us? I'm terrified of my nonfiction coming out. I have to pretend that no one's going to read it. That's the only way I can fool myself, right? Yeah. But at some point, it's going to come out, and then y'all will know things about me that I don't really, you know, I don't know how you're going to take it, right? And so what's your advice for us?
Well, I think it's exactly what you're saying. So almost every day that I wrote this book, I told myself often out loud that I wasn't going to let anyone read it. And so I kept saying often out loud, no one will see this. It's just for you. It's okay. I kept this lie intact until quite literally the day before the book came out. And then the day the book came out, I was like, oh no. My lie has gone. It's disappeared.
Well, that's probably why you put the box in the closet.
That was why I kept chucking the box into the closet. That box is still in the closet. Mm. I still can't like handle. I should like give that book to friends, and I'm just like, it's too much. But I was so afraid of the lie falling apart that on the day this book came out, and again, it was just 2 weeks ago. I woke up and like friends were texting me saying, how do you feel? Because, you know, my friends knew that they'd been hearing plenty about the fears all along. And I was like, I didn't die. I'm alive so far, knock on wood. And they were like, you're alive, knocking on wood. Great, so far. And yeah.
Have you heard anything from your family members?
So my family, the wildest event so far has been the one in LA, which is where most of my family lives. And it was with Margaret Cho, who is, you know, she's a queen. She's iconic. And it was amazing to talk with her. And my family was sitting in the entire first row. family and longtime family friends who've known me since I was 10 years old, and my aunt and my cousin, and just like they were all staring at me.
But you had Margaret Cho on your side. I think you were good.
I have never in my life, Nami, been more grateful for the slight language barrier between me and the elders, because there were things that we talked about. So for instance, I'll give you one moment of hilarity that my parents didn't quite register. So, you know, Margaret Cho was talking about, and she has 25 years of experience in the kink communities. She was saying it's so ridiculous that people think submissive people are weak. And she said, "I can take a fist." And the whole room erupted with laughter. And then helplessly I glanced at my parents and they looked gently puzzled at first, and then my father actually start nodding approvingly.
Oh.
And I realized what they thought Margaret said was that she can fight.
Yeah.
And my father believed strongly that, like, especially women, that we should know how to fight. He normally in Taekwondo when I was a kid. And then, like, there were just kept being multiple moments like this. Like, she was talking about rope suspension, and I was like, oh my God. And my parents were just like, and I was like, great. Yeah. This is, thank God. There are things that, like, are not registering.
Yeah. Margaret's doing trapeze artistry. That's all. That's what that is. Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious. I wish I could have had that. I would have wanted a close up of your parents on that one.
A friend, a wonderful friend, Priyanka Matu, who has a book coming out. It's fantastic. It's coming out in a month or so. She sent me pictures of my parents in their first row, and their faces just keep looking like
actually, now that we're talking, how would you feel if this were translated into Korean? I didn't want my first book to be translated. I actually said no to the Korean translation because I was just terrified that somebody might, you know, somebody whom I knew would read it. So I said no. How do you feel about the fact that it could be translated into Korean?
So this is a present problem because the translation rights have been sold into Korean, and it's with the publisher I loved working with for the first book, and I don't know what I'm gonna do. It's obvious, I tend to kick problems like this down the road. And so I've been plotting things. I'm just like, can I get them to sign a contract? And even if they sign the contract, my mother, her relationship with things like this is like, for instance, okay, I'll just tell a quick story. They really wanted me to get married to a Korean American Catholic doctor. And when I got engaged to someone who is not Korean, not Catholic, and not a doctor, my mother was really upset, and she really insisted on our having a priest involved, etc. For a variety of reasons, I caved on having a priest involved. Because it meant so much to her. But at some point, I was just like, what am I supposed to say if the priest asks basic questions like, are you a Catholic? And my answer is absolutely not. And nor is my partner. And she was like, Ogyeong, just lie. That's, what do you think confession is for? And so if she signed the contract, I know she'd go back on it. I've thought about actually making dummy copies of this book, of just putting in some other like lovely Korean American's book, and that's been translated to Korean and passing that to my parents and being like, here you go. But they very lovingly stalk me on social media and on the internet, and they read all my interviews. So that wouldn't work either.
Yeah.
My mother bewilderingly has been, so my partner sometimes will put up on Instagram stories things about my book, including, Vogue, and this wonderful writer, Emma Spector, bless their heart. The title said something like, Exhibit is hands down the sexiest book of the year. And my partner put that up on Instagram stories. My mother bewilderingly sent him a fire emoji, and then did not comment on it to me, said nothing, and then to my partner sent a fire emoji. So I don't even know what's going on. I'm just very confused. And
just pretend that they're not reading. It's okay. Sometimes when it took you 9 years to write this book, since I know that there are some writers out here, sometimes when I'm really lost in a project and I'm just trying to slow down the sinking of the into the quicksand, I have to tell myself, I have to approve the method that I'm doing. I have to tell myself that this is all good. You are coming up with your own method for this one particular book, and all of it will work out in the end, and I have to keep approving my wacky methods to get through. Did you ever have a moment here in this book, in the 9 years that you've been working on, where you were lost and you weren't sure how to get yourself out of that sense of confusion? Were you ever there, or did you know right away?
No, so many points where I just kept asking myself, especially because this book was physically costing so much, and I just kept asking, like, what if I just wrote something else? What if, like, and what am I doing? And then I feel as though so often when I've had a hard writing day, the questions, existential questions start coming up, like, why am I doing this? What am I doing with my life? I spent the whole day moving around some commas and then I deleted the page. Why didn't I become a dermatologist? I'd have made a great dermatologist. I could have been a cheesemonger. All these questions start coming up. And then, but I think what helps keep me with a book, because my first book took 10 years. I like saying this to people because I feel as though it helps people feel relaxed about their projects. People are always like, oh, mine is only, I'm only 3 years in. Like, I'm like way ahead of this situation. But they were overlapping. There were about 4 years when I was working. Every time I was waiting to hear back about the first book, I was working on this one. Something that has helped me a lot is to ask myself over and over, who are you writing for? One of the first ideas of who I'm writing for is a 17-year-old version of myself who at times felt like the loneliest person alive. I knew I didn't win that crown. I knew there were other people who would compete with me for that crown, but there were times when I just felt like the most desperately lonely person alive. And I so badly want her to know that she was never alone and I was there all along, which is, of course, also a way of letting some part of myself, like the 17-year-old still in me, mm-hmm. letting her know that she's not alone. And when I think about that, that has an urgency to it that can mm-hmm. help bring me back to the page.
Yeah. Having that one specific audience member in mind, I think, does keep you going. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Oh, wow. We have a lot of questions. Okay. I'll just do the... here's a softball one. You ready? Can you speak about the photography that inspired aspects of this book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been, I did a lot of research into both the photography and the ballet. I took photo classes, very elementary ballet classes, a choreography workshop. Part of this is because the way I write, I need to know what the bodies of my characters are up to. And without that, I have trouble imagining as fully as I hope to. And so, I spent so much time just staring at photos, I've posted quite a few of the ones that meant something to me on Instagram, which I realized is a great place, because I wanted to like put them in the book, but like getting photo rights is really expensive and it was impossible. Part of what led me, I think, to Jen being a photographer, because I knew I wanted her to be an artist. I wanted this book to be centered in art. I really didn't want to write a novelist, which is what I am. And even though I love reading books that have novelists as central characters, but, you know, I was just like, I just wanted something else. And I thought about so many possibilities. I thought about poet, but I was like, God damn it. But if I make her a poet, if she's a poet, then I have to include poetry. And I know I'm not a poet. I love reading poetry. If I could pick my life, I'd want to be a poet. But I'm not a poet. And then I was like, playwright? And then I was like, playwright. But everything that's very collaborative felt very foreign to me. I love control. This is a gross generalization, but I feel as though novelists kind of tend to love control. We make up our whole world rather than a whole world that is contained inside a book rather than fully exist in this one. We have full control over every word of what's in here. There's not a comma in there that wasn't mine. We have tons of control over the cover as well, etc. And so I was like, playwright, gotta collaborate with people. They might not do exactly what you want, don't understand. And then so I got to photographer because I'm fascinated by photos and relationship with reality and with how they, it's very slippery, right? It's very elusive. And it's an illusion, but the way they can almost seem to capture a little bit of time. And I'm fascinated by that in part because one of the central preoccupations of this book and of pretty much everything I write, has to do with this loss of faith, which just remains a pivotal loss for me. My life is divided into before and after. And the grief of that has never really lessened at all. One of the great griefs around it, and Jin talks about this too, is One of the parts of the grief and one of the parts of the rage that come with grief is that I have nothing left of it. You know, when you lose something as ephemeral as a god, I don't have pictures. I don't have a body. And I'm getting emotional again. It's impossible to talk about without me getting emotional. But it's but so that's part of why Jin is obsessed with photos, because that's a way of keeping something, keeping a part of what time will take.
Yeah. All right, since that one was kind of heavy, do you want a heavy question, a craft question, or kind of a funny question?
Any which way.
This one's nice and broad. Does exhibit have a political underlined dimension?
Well, I would be on the side of people who say that everything we write and do is political, you know, that every word of what we that's in a novel is political. And you know, it's political that I'm writing in English, you know. It's my third language, and it's the one I'm the most fluent in. And I write in English, and it's my most fluent, and I love the language. I love it so much. It's so capacious. I love how flexible it is, how it just folds in like all these other words, the number of words, like my most prized material possession, because I'm not someone who's super into a lot of material possession, or I don't get attached, is I got, after I published my first book, I got an OED, I got an Oxford English Dictionary, the like 20 volume whole thing. I got it used from a bookstore, and it is so sacred to me. Like, you can open like this entry for a word like red is like 20 pages long. And it just like goes through the history of the word, tracing it from its beginning to the extent possible. Another alternate life I think I'd have really enjoyed is being a lexicographer, yeah, specifically for the OED. I have this vision that I'd be in like a tweed, I don't know why I'd be in a tweed jacket, I think because it's, you know, maybe it has something to do with Oxford, but in a tweed jacket.
And you have a
with
quill.
Elbow pouches.
You have a quill.
I think, yeah. I imagine banging on a table and arguing for or against a word, and yeah, I think that'd be super exciting. It'd be so thrilling. And I love English, but it's political that I write in English. Like, my family came here. I write in English because in large part because of the forces of imperialism. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's a lot that's more overtly political in the book too, I would say. Including the parts about how Asian women and people who present as women are viewed, and who gets to want what, really. Mm-hmm. is a big political question, yeah, throughout the book.
Yeah. And I'm bringing in incendiaries now, where I think in that book, both books have reproductive themes of, or motifs of reproductive issues. That one is an abortion clinic, right? And then this one, not wanting to reproduce, not wanting to procreate. Yeah. And so all of that is political, right? Yeah.
Oh, and I'll just give this little bit away. Elise, who's the artist and photographer, who's Jin's closest friend. Jin admires her so much for her boldness. And in college, Elise had a big project, a series of photos that involved taking pictures of people after they'd had an abortion. But all they're doing is going about their lives. So they're like drinking wine. They're just, they're dancing. They might be like walking, and that's it. And their faces are covered only because of the potential repercussions of, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that shows up in a local sort of like in the local news, because a visiting artist really likes, Elise's work. And so Elise gets a lot of hate mail for this. And then she's interviewed, and she says at some point, and she's asked, do you wish you'd gone with something less controversial, like miscarriages? And she says, actually, what this has inspired me to do is, she says, I would, and she says, if, honestly, this has inspired me to learn how to give abortion to myself. I'm going to join the underground. And so thank you, everyone, for inspiring this. And this brings more hate, yeah, mail. And then she writes in red paint on a blanket or a poster. And she writes, because now somebody sends a bottle through her window, and that's scary. And then she writes in red paint, I will find you. And, yeah, then she hangs it from her window. and then finally the threats stop. Anyway, so there's a little bit of politics in there.
Yeah, I would say there's politics in there, but also, oh, that's the other, you and I have this in common. We both, I think, volunteered for Planned Parenthood.
Oh, yeah.
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 I
mean,
I was a patient escort. I walked
Me
people.
Too.
Oh my God. Hello.
I remember reading that somewhere.
High five.
Sister. I know. Okay, so here's a, let's see. It's a long one. Let's see. Seeing parallels between the incendiaries and exhibit such as art as surrogacy for religion, in my interpretation or in their interpretation. Why else did you decide to tangibly connect the two stories through things like news articles and shared social connections between characters?
Yeah, so I was surprised. I don't ever quite feel as though I make decisions when it comes to novel writing. I feel as though I'm following the characters, asking them to show me who they are, asking the book to tell me what it is, to help me, help it become the most truthful living version of itself. But the books are very, very lightly connected, loosely. So there are, most excitingly for me, there's a big open question at the end of the incendiaries, and at the end of the incendiaries that a lot of people ask me about. And I was like, I don't know more than the book knows. There's a fate of a character that's left sort of open. And in this book, there's more of an indication given as to what might have happened. Jin in her work, at some point works with some of what happens in the incendiaries, because some of the characters in this book go to the same school as the abortion clinic bombing cult situation, in the first book. I think what I'm working toward is if I live that long, given how long these books take, a trilogy or a quartet maybe of loosely connected books that share preoccupations. Mm-hmm. And I think that ended up happening because, again, it wasn't planned. But by the time I finished the first book, the world of it felt so alive to me. It felt as though it maybe existed, which I know doesn't quite make sense. But it's also true that if something so large as an abortion, because in that book, 5 abortion clinics are bombed. If something like that had happened, that materially changes the whole country. Y'all have heard about the butterfly effect, like one change then affects the future. I love reading physics for lay people when I'm extra depressed about the state of the world. Just like as if quantum physics and how they're like, there are infinite universes and et cetera, et cetera. I find that to be very calming when the news is just horrible, to be like, there are infinite universes. There's a universe where we didn't do this to the planet. There are universes where the news that is happening is not happening right now. But I almost feel as though the world of the incendiaries exists. And then therefore this world exists in that world, and so it's not quite fully this world. It's a little different.
Yeah. Now you made me think. Now I'm going back to Clarice Lispector, the epigraph you have, the hour of the star. I think the beginning of that book is, isn't it something like it all began with a yes, like one atom said yes to the other atom, and that line makes me feel really good about the world. I sort of go back to us on an atomic level, like. Okay, we're just a bunch of electrons spinning around right now, right? And we're a quark. We're just a quark right now. I'm going to end with like a last question you said, right? What has been the funniest thing that has happened so far on your book tour? Let's end with a little lighter question. Anything weird happen, funny, besides Margaret Cho? That was already good. That was already... I mean, you can't top Margaret Cho.
Funniest thing that has happened on the book tour other than the fisting. Let's see.
Or in any book tour, even including the first one.
On any book tour. How am I blanking? Because certainly funny things have happened. I should just be able to make something up. I'm a novelist. My mother would be like, just lie.
I threw you off. I'm sorry. Are you able to write while you're on book tour?
I wasn't on the first one, and for this one, I had such high hopes. I was like, I've learned from the last one. I'm going to be so enlightened. I'm going to write so much during. I've never been so blocked for my writing in my entire life. For months, since August, literally since I stopped this book, I've never had so much trouble writing. I think maybe because this book took more out of me in a lot of ways than the first book. I think in some ways I'm still recovering.
Okay.
And I was hoping to be able to write fiction while I was on book tour, and it hasn't happened. And my big goal for myself is the day I get home, I just want to hurl myself into the next book, because I don't, I think the way some of us are built, and it doesn't have to be true for everybody. Not every novelist I know wants to write every day. I feel best if I'm writing every single day. I just start feeling increasingly dead inside if I'm not writing fiction every day. So hoping for that.
Well, we're hoping to, because we can't wait to read your next book. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you
out,
so much
everyone.
For being here. Thank you, Nami. Thank you.
Thank you. Your books.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.